We're reading in chapter 27 and from the 41st verse, a passage which deals with the immediate aftermath of Jacob's deception as he suffers or begins to suffer the consequences of that. And we find God there too to pick up the pieces. Genesis 27 and reading from the 41st verse. Esau held a grudge against David because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." When Rebekah was told what her older son Esau had said, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is consoling himself with the thought of killing you. Now then, my son, do what I say. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay with him for a while until your brother's fury subsides. When your brother is no longer angry with you and forgets what you did to him, I'll send word for you to come back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am disgusted with living because of these Hittite women. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living." So Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him and commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Paddan Aram, to the house of your mother's father Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and increase your numbers until you become a community of peoples. May He give you and your descendants the blessing given to Abraham, so that you may take possession of the land where you now live as an alien, the land God gave to Abraham." Then Isaac sent Jacob on his way. He went to Paddan Aram, to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, who was the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now Esau learned that Jacob had blessed Jacob and sent him to Paddan Aram to take a wife from there, and that he had blessed him, and that when he blessed him, he commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite woman." And Jacob had obeyed his father and mother and gone to Paddan Aram. Esau then realized how displeasing the Canaanite women were to his father Isaac. So he went to Ishmael and married Mahla, the sister of Nebaioth, the daughter of Ishmael, son of Abraham, in addition to the wives he already had. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land in which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you. When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, though the city used to be called Luz. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of that, and of all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading of his holy word. Close of 27 and Genesis 28. The will of God is like an anvil. It's there for us to be conformed to. I suppose in the same way that a metal bar can be bent on an anvil and made into something useful, so our human wills can be bent on the anvil of God's will, so that we are molded into instruments useful in his service. And the story of Jacob is really the story of a bar of metal that is gradually bent and molded into the shape of God's will on God's anvil. We have already seen something of Jacob's stubborn self-will and his capacity to deceive in order to try and get what he wanted. We've discovered, too, that when we attempt to secure the blessing of God in the wrong way, we end up impoverishing rather than enriching our lives. Jacob had outwitted his father. He had enraged his brother with his deception in chapter 27, verse 18 following, and there was a terrible price to pay. We read that Esau planned to murder Jacob once the old man was dead and buried. He had a plan. Isaac may well have submitted to the will of God that Jacob should be the son to receive God's blessing and all that that blessing entailed, but there was no such submission in Esau's heart. Only hatred, and hatred that refused to stop at anything short of murder. A calm domestic scene, far from it. Can you imagine the distress of mind and heart which this caused Rebecca? Her favorite son, Jacob, was sitting on a time bomb. She needed a rescue package. She needed a contingency plan to deliver her favorite from Esau's hatred. And as we read through the closing verses of chapter 27, we discover that Rebekah had learned nothing at all from her previous deception. For we discover, once again, she sets out to deceive her husband. Instead of voicing her fears for Jacob's safety, she expresses concern that Jacob might make a bad marriage. Verse 46. Then Rebekah said to Isaac, I am disgusted with living because of these Hittite women, idolaters, you see. If Jacob takes a wife from among the women of this land, from Hittite women like these, my life will not be worth living. She wanted her son to marry a believer, and she was right to be concerned about who Jacob married, but wrong to disguise the real motive for wanting to send him away. And one finds oneself asking the question, had deceit taken such a root in Rebekah's heart that it is now second nature for her to deceive rather than come out and simply tell the truth? Deception seems to be the natural way forward for Rebekah. Racing through the story, Isaac blesses Jacob and sends him away. But Esau reveals his pettiness. He feels he has been badly treated. His parents don't want Jacob to marry a Canaanite woman. Very well, he says. That's precisely what I intend to do. If they don't want that, if that's going to hurt them and make them miserable, that's what I will do. I will do this, he says to himself, not to benefit me, but to hurt them. That's what's going on in Esau's heart. And you know, that is often the reaction of anger. It is more concerned to harm the object of its anger than to consider the harm that it might do itself. And time again, people react in this way. I will hurt them, giving no second thought to how much harm this course of action might cause them. Well, the upshot of all of this, of course, is that Jacob left the family home. It must have been with a heavy heart and no little amount of fearful trepidation as he journeyed through a dangerous desert out into the unknown. It was a journey of some 500 miles, and that doesn't seem much today, but then it was a considerable journey. And it must have seemed to Jacob that he was abandoning the very blessing which he had schemed so hard to secure. And as the sun set that evening, and he put his head down on a stone pillow, he must have felt as though the light had gone out and the sun had set on all of his dreams and aspirations. But as far as God was concerned, the succeeding years would be years of preparation, bringing Jacob to the place where he was equipped to receive and enjoy the full blessing of God. This is the remarkable thing about the story of Jacob. God was determined to bless Jacob despite Jacob. It's remarkable. Despite Jacob, God was determined to bless him. Jacob was going to discover, in Shakespeare's words, that there is a divinity which shapes our end, rough hew them how we will. In the school of God's grace, we frequently discover that there are things being torn from our grasp until we learn to hold them in an open hand. That's what Jacob had to learn concerning the blessing, concerning his inheritance. There are things that are torn from our grasp until we can learn to hold them in an open hand, until we see them for what they are, God's gifts to be used in his service and not our possessions to be selfishly guarded. And it's in this situation that we find God revealing himself to Jacob. And the first thing I want you to notice is the timing of God's revelation. He comes to Jacob when Jacob is most aware of his own vulnerability. Here is Jacob in the desert, conscious of his failure, conscious of his isolation, conscious of his danger. He was in a mess of his own making and knew it. His circumstances were unenviable. And it was precisely at that time that God revealed himself and made himself known. Jacob's first encounter with God happened then. Why? Because here, Jacob is at his most receptive. You see, he has begun to see and understand the folly of his own overweening self-confidence, and to discover how frail that tower of self-reliance really was. And in coming to Jacob at this time, God is saying, Jacob, listen, I don't need your assistance in order to fulfill my promises to you. Indeed, the promises that I have made to you are going to be fulfilled despite the mess of complications which you have injected into the situation. Now, is that not of tremendous encouragement? It should be to so many of us, that God comes to us when we are most conscious of our failures, when we are still licking our wounds. And think about it, that is a time when other people so often don't want to have anything to do with us. Everybody likes a winner. They do not want to be associated with a failure, with a loser. But God isn't like everybody else. Notice the method God chooses to reveal himself to Jacob and what that method signifies. How would you have dealt with Jacob, I wonder? Would you have begun by berating him for his sin of deception? Or would you have lectured him on the folly of impatience? God exercises a tremendous restraint and sensitivity. You see, when someone is crushed by their failure, you do not rub their faces in it. And instead, God reveals himself to Jacob by giving him a vision of a ladder or a staircase that stretches all the way up to heaven. What is God saying in all of this? Among other things, God is teaching this failure, that failures discover God is neither inaccessible or remote. That God is a God who reaches down to men in their deepest need. And this is what Jacob needed to know about God in all of his aloneness. He might be cut off from his mother. He might be cut off from the family home and from any friends he may have had there among the servants. But God is still accessible. No matter where he is, even in the wildest desert, God is still accessible. And the accessibility of God is one of the greatest encouragements to the broken and the crushed in spirit to know that God is there and only a prayer away. I wonder, is there someone here this evening who finds themselves in that condition, crushed in spirit, experiencing a tremendous sense of aloneness? God is not remote. God is accessible. God does more, however, than provide Jacob with a vision, significant though its symbolism is. Notice that Jacob's greatest comfort comes through God's word. God speaks to Jacob a powerful word of promise, and you will notice that the promise made to Rebekah concerning Jacob, which he attempted to fulfill by human guile, is now made personal by God. But more than that, the promise of verse 13 of chapter 28 following, is far, far more comprehensive than that which had been made earlier to his mother. This is a promise which is tailor-made to meet every point of Jacob's need. I wonder, have you ever found yourself in that position where you have tried to wrap up a present, to give it some adequate protection for the post, only to discover that the paper is too small, and that no matter how you try to wrap it up, the paper doesn't quite reach. It doesn't quite cover the parcel. It doesn't quite provide adequate protection. I've known the experience time and again, as some of you by the smiles on your faces have too. But you see, God is saying to Jacob, you will never be able to think of me in those terms. I'm not like a short piece of paper. I will meet you at every single point of your need. Now, very quickly, think of those needs and how God intends to meet them through the promise that he makes to Jacob. First of all, notice there is the promise of divine presence. I am with you, says God. How that word must have ministered to Jacob's sense of being desperately, hopelessly alone. Is that a word that someone needs to hear this evening? Someone who perhaps feels in some measure a sense of aloneness. God drawing near and saying, I am with you. You're not alone. I'm with you. Secondly, notice the promise of divine protection. I will watch over you. Jacob was out in the desert, more conscious than ever before of every sound and every shadow. Did he imagine Esau jumping out from behind every dark rock in that desert? God promised his protection. I will watch over you. Perhaps someone here is fearful of the hostile world outside, or of some situation in the future which looms up largely. And you need to hear words like these. I will watch over you. God is saying to Jacob, I'll be your minder. I'll look out for you. I'll be your minder. Thirdly, notice the promise of divine provision. I give you and your descendants the land in which you are lying. Now we know that Jacob came from a very wealthy family back in chapter 26 and verses 13 and 14. We read these words concerning his father Isaac. The man became rich and his wealth continued to grow until he became very wealthy. He had so many flocks and herds and servants that the Philistines envied him. That's Jacob's home. Now, Jacob was not from an impoverished nomadic family. His father was a prince in the desert. He had the wealth of a prince. And all of a sudden, the little rich boy discovers himself in the desert with only a few possessions beside him. How is he going to cope? How is he going to face the future? How is he going to pay his way? Impoverished. And in the midst of his impoverishment, and into that impoverishment comes the promise of divine provision. I get a great kick out of telling Christians that they are the richest people in the world. You are, if you're a Christian, you are one of the wealthiest persons in the world. You are a millionaire, a spiritual millionaire, and more than that, you're an heir to the indescribable riches that are Christ's. And God comes to his people time and again when they see the wealth that surrounds them and they think, how am I going to survive in the midst of this kind of environment? And God says, but listen, look at your inheritance. Look at all that is yours in Christ Jesus. Don't tell me that you're impoverished when all of that has been placed at your disposal. Fourthly, Jacob was haunted by a sense of shame and disgrace. News of his deceptive behavior would have reached the ears of many of the servants in his father's family. Esau would have seen to that. Dishonor and disgrace hung around his head. And into that situation, God speaks a word designed to raise his head. All the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring, says God. This is a great promise because it demonstrates that no matter how badly we have acted in the past, God is able to begin with us anew and to work through us and to bless others through us. And one needs to ask this evening, are there some here devastated because of their past? Is your head hanging low? Is there some skeleton that constantly attempts to pop out of your cupboard? A cloud of shame God is a God of new beginning. He was for Jacob, and he can be for you as he comes to you and says, despite that past, I will bless you. Yes, and make you a blessing to others. Now, how is Jacob going to respond to this remarkable revelation of God, both in terms of the vision that he sees and the words of promise that he hears? A true encounter with God will always produce a sense of awe and godly fear. It will either mark the beginning of a relationship with God, or it will cause men to shy away from following after him. Here is how A.W. Tozer describes the matter, and I quote, "Just as some men shy away from marriage when they realize what it involves, so men shy away when they suddenly realize that being a Christian involves a relationship with, and no printed words can convey the awe and the wonder that should be in our voices when we say the last word of this sentence, with God." Jacob did not shy away from God. From this point on, Jacob entered into a personal relationship with God. His knowledge of God is no longer second hand, no longer mere facts he had picked up in the family home. His knowledge of God was for the first time personal and experimental. And God wanted to enter into a relationship with a man as twisted and as deceitful as Jacob was, then and there. He did not wait until Jacob improved before closing in on him and drawing him to himself. Isn't that marvelously reassuring? God came to a twister and entered into a personal relationship with a twister. He didn't say to Jacob, "I'm waiting for you to sort your life out, and then I'll come and tell you that I want to be your God and you can be my man." Let me ask the young people who are here this evening, not exclusively the young people, but particularly the young people, those of you who come from Christian homes, are you able to say that God is known to you as a person, a friend, as someone who is real to you? Do you know God because you have a relationship with him? Or do you merely know things about him that parents have taught you, or you've learned in Sunday school or youth fellowship? There is a world of difference, you see, between knowing about someone and knowing them because you have a relationship with them. I wonder if there are some here who have yet to discover, as Jacob did, that God is not remote and second hand, but gloriously real. A real God. Someone that you can speak to, and someone who speaks to you. A true encounter with God, which proves fruitful, will mean that we are never the same kind of people again. One thing it will always do is to begin to subdue our hearts. John Calvin, the great reformer and preacher, was a prolific writer. Now, I'm fortunate to have many volumes of his work in my study, and you're welcome to read them all if you care to do so. But if you were to take time to read all that Calvin ever wrote, you would, to the best of my knowledge, find only one personal reference to his conversion to Christ. Only one sentence. And it is perhaps the fact that he has written only one sentence which makes its content so important. And I quote, "God, by a sudden conversion, subdued my heart to teachableness." Now, do you see what Calvin is saying? He was never the same again after this encounter with God. He once possessed a rebellious and an unsubdued heart, an unteachable heart. But meeting with God, he says, changed all that. By a sudden conversion, God subdued my heart to teachableness. He recognized God's authority in his life. Now, in some measure, Calvin's experience was Jacob's experience. Jacob's heart is subdued. He begins to recognize the authority of God in his life. And part and parcel of that submission is found in the vow that he makes in verse 20. Then Jacob made a vow saying, "If God will be with me and watch over me on this journey I am taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house," and so on. Now, of course, there is a very real measure of immaturity associated with this vow. Jacob had real difficulty in understanding the nature of God's covenant promise and the sheer grace in which God's promise is rooted. To someone like Jacob, grace seemed too good to be true. And there is still a lot of the schemer left in the man. And that's evident from the form which the vow takes, for it's really more of a bargain. He's saying to God, "If you do this to me, then I'll do that for you. You give me X, Y, and Z, and I'll be your follower." Now, here is the remarkable thing. God comes to a man who has begun to measure God by his own standards, to a man who is looking for a partnership with mutual benefits. And many people, including young Christians, often think in this way today. Yet, despite Jacob's failure to grasp the kind of grace relationship which God intends to sustain with his people, God begins where Jacob is. Important to grasp that. God begins where Jacob is. Jacob is yet to learn that under the name of grace, which you can't bargain for or earn, under the name of grace, all spiritual good comes wrapped up. And yet here is the condescension, the amazing condescension of God. He is prepared to begin with our imperfect grasp of who he is and how he works. For he knows how to school his saints how to produce a clearer understanding and a deeper submission to his rule in their lives. How does the story conclude? Jacob set up a memorial stone at Bethel. He names the place Bethel, House of God, to remind him of his encounter with and submission to the will of God. He wanted a tangible, physical reminder of the time and the place where he had such intimate dealings with God himself. And he raises this stone with that in view. Memory is such a defective thing. When we remember events, we so easily distort them, or we can become selective in the particular things that we choose to remember. It's even possible to lose sight of the intensity and the significance of some events in our lives. For this reason, Christians of a former generation kept diaries to record God's dealings with them. I know of one person who did so for a while, but his heart grew cold towards God and his obedience waned, and God seemed remote and incredibly far off. And then he picked up his spiritual journal one day, and the last entry had been made some 10 years previously. And as he read the words that he had written of his encounter with God then, his memory was quickened and his appetite for God kindled afresh. Now, just as the stone which Jacob raised would remind him of God's dealings with him in years to come, I wonder if this evening God is eager to remind someone here of a past forgotten encounter. Of a time when God dealt kindly and graciously with you. A time when, as a result of that, you gave to him wholehearted consecration and commitment. The submission of your will and your heart to God. And does that memory shame and challenge you as you consider your present commitment to him, as you look back on that Bethel?